We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Five Star App Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host every other week, Ariel Garten, co-founder of Muse, the brain sensing headband. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation and mindfulness practices have the power to change our lives. If you've ever heard the term biohacking, you've probably heard of today's guest, Dave Asprey. Dave is the author of New York Times bestseller, The Bulletproof Diet, Headstrong, and his new book, Game Changers, What Leaders, Innovators, and Mavericks Do to Win at Life. Dave's also the creator of the company Bulletproof Coffee and host of his health podcast, Bulletproof Radio. What got him into biohacking in the first place? Dave lost 100 pounds without counting calories or excessive exercise using techniques that he shares here to upgrade his brain, sleep more efficiently, and, he says, lower his biological age. He shares how we can take more control of our own biochemistry with the hacks that he's learned throughout his journey. In Game Changers, he shares what he has identified as the 46 laws of high performance, based on his own experience and the interviews he's done with over 500 Game Changers on his podcast. He's found common patterns. One big lesson he shares is the importance of finding your purpose and relentlessly going after it. He says the big winners that he interviewed all had a strong purpose, but they also figured out what they needed to do or learn in order to live that purpose. There are lots of biohacking and wisdom gems in this interview. Now, here's Dave. Dave Asprey, it is so great to have you on Untangle today. I want to start with, can you tell me a little bit about Dave as a 10-year-old? What were you like as a young child?
I was definitely dealing with some substantial inflammation, which affects your brain as well. I had some OCD, definitely ADHD. And what's that? Oppositional defiant disorder. I think that was my special skill at that age. So definitely got in a lot of trouble. And I understand now where all that kind of stuff comes from. But yeah, it was probably not a fun time for me.
So do you remember, is that your earliest memory, having the oppositional defiant disorder? And did you know at the time that it had to do with your body and inflammation, or this is like, as you look back right now?
No one knows that. When you're a kid, you're like, I have a feeling, and you don't even know how your feelings are. That's the first time I had that feeling, or the first time I noticed it. So your feelings are kind of scary for young children. And I remember the first time, like, I don't know what I'm feeling, but it's here in my stomach or my chest and So no, I had no idea. All I knew was like, I was pretty pissed off and like, I'm just not going to do what they want me to do and all that sort of thing. And of course, like any kid, kids have friends and they have things that they like and things they don't like, but I pretty much read a lot and didn't understand humans at all.
You mean, as you grew older, did you feel like you were just different from other kids? Were you depressed?
I wasn't depressed that I'm aware of. I was definitely different from other kids, but I think pretty much most people who end up being engineers or entrepreneurs or artists or anything else like that would tell you the same thing. So that's part of being a kid, is feeling no one understands me.
Right. So when did you transition into thinking about high performers, and what was your pivotal point for changing all of that was going on with you as a young child?
When you're a young child, you don't even know how much control you have. But as I evolved, when I was 14, the doctor told me that I had arthritis in my knees. And I'm like, that was for old people.
Right.
I'm just a kid.
Like, yeah.
What's going on with this? And it kind of freaked me out. And I knew that my knees hurt all the time. I was wearing like NFL knee braces and my feet hurt all the time. And like I had lots of muffin top and I rode my bike all the time and I was still fat. And I was always, I'd ride my bike like 10 miles a day. And like I did all this stuff that by any definition should have resulted in me being lean and healthy and energetic, especially as a kid. It didn't work. Even back then, if you come into the world and you believe the world a certain way and you sense it that way, that's just normal. But and there's no way for you to know, even as an adult, like, oh, what's normal for me is completely off for other people. Like, I had no idea you're supposed to be able to walk around without it hurting because it always hurts. So I went, oh, that's just the human condition. And it turns out maybe I had a few things going on that I could fix.
I really like what you're saying about as a kid. And I think even as an adult, like we live with so many emotional, physical, and spiritual ailments, if you will. And so many people don't know that they can make big changes in their lives, or they're so deeply immersed in their habits that they see no way out of them. And so I think that to me is what's so interesting about the work that you do, that it pushes all of these boundaries. And that feeling that you had when you had arthritis in your knees and you thought that that was like a normal way to feel, it was normal to feel angry, it was normal to feel uncomfortable. When did you actually realize that that wasn't the case?
I didn't figure that out until much later in life. I started in my early 20s, really getting serious about this. I got to lose weight. And by the time I was in my third or fourth year of university, I hit 300 pounds. The weight just kept coming on and I would try working out. I'd try these different things and I ended up working out an hour and a half a day, 6 days a week, went on a low fat, low calorie diet, didn't lose any weight. All that effort, just prioritizing exercise and eating, which it turns out was exactly the wrong diet. I was strong, but I was still fat and just really frustrated and pretty angry about the whole situation. And then I'm sitting at this coffee shop in a farming town in Central California where I was living, and I picked up a bodybuilding magazine. And in the 90s, at least when I went to high school, I didn't have any bodybuilding friends. Now it's sort of considered cool. It's something that a socially acceptable thing to do. Back then where I lived, it was like, that's not something that you would do because someone would probably hit you with a shovel or something in a farming community. But I'm like, you know what? I'm going to pick this thing up because it's here on the magazine rack at this coffee shop. And it said how to grow abs. And it was so far from my world. I'm like, all right, maybe these guys know something because I'm lost. Nothing works. So I read the thing and said, hey, carbs can make you fat. And this was long before we have the bulletproof diet, all these different things where we understand the mechanisms. We're just early biohackers saying, I want my body to look a certain way and here's all the tools. So I did a crappy job of cutting out carbs, which accidentally included not eating wheat for a little while. And my friends and my family are like, Dave, your personality just changed. Like, you're not angry all the time. Like, what's going on? We like this new version of you. And I lost 50 pounds in 3 months. The other 50 pounds took 10 years to come off because that's inflammation versus just the very basic stuff. And now, you know, I've lost my 100 pounds of fat. I've kept it off for many years, but that's a side effect of making your cells work well, which makes your brain work really well. So you get tons more energy. And then you just realize I have to keep buying new pants and they're always smaller.
This was initially just from taking wheat out of your diet, or were you doing a number? Was it the whole carb thing?
Well, initially, I didn't even know how to implement this. Okay. You know, I'm a 22 or 23 or something. And you read the article, you go, oh, what's a carb?
Right.
And right. This is a serious thing. In 1990, a lot of people couldn't spell carbohydrate. Like, we just did not have the awareness that's in our world today. So I remember for breakfast, I was doing orange juice and cottage cheese. That's not a low carb breakfast, but it was lower carb than the low fat bagel with a low fat spread of some kind of crappy thing on it. And the difference metabolically was pretty meaningful. So I'm like, wow, all right, something happened. So you go to lunch and you get the chicken breast and whatever vegetables instead of whatever. So it was a higher protein. It wasn't a ketogenic diet. I just avoided foods that are known to cause inflammation that were high in carbs. And you fast forward 500,000 copies of the Bulletproof Diet later, and it turns out plants have compounds in them that are there to keep you from eating them, and whole grains are one of those. If I'd have been eating white rice instead of brown rice, maybe, even though I think it's bad for you too, white flour versus whole wheat flour is actually a better choice. And neither one is a good choice, though. It's sort of like, do you want to smoke a cigar or a cigarette? Like, well, probably neither one. But whatever it was, I went through that whole path and I eliminated the things that made me weak inadvertently. And I became very scientific about figuring out what are the things that cause problems in human biology that we don't know about that we do every day. Maybe let's just stop doing that before we go lift heavy things or try intermittent fasting and do all these other practices that are really powerful. But why would you try to get stronger when you're walking around carrying a whole bunch of crap you don't need? Like, just set that down and then go get stronger and you'll find a lot better results. And that's how the approach is now.
So you were motivated by your own situation to lose the weight, and then you were experimenting with the different dietary changes. Was that the original, like, well, sort of light bulb went off?
Weight loss is kind of a motivator, but anyone who's listening to this who's fat is going to know exactly what I'm talking about. It's not about the weight loss. You desperately want to look good in the mirror, but you don't want to be tired all the time. It's that I'm exhausted. My brain isn't working well, because when you put on fat like that, you will not be taking that energy from food and turning it into thoughts and turning it into control of your emotions. It's a normal thing for what I actually believe that fat people are willpower athletes. Because every single day, you don't have enough energy because your body's shunting energy into fat storage. And you're also telling yourself, oh, I'm not going to eat even though I'm getting a signal from my body that I need to eat. So you're constantly hungry, even if you just ate, and you're low on energy. It's the worst possible situation. And that creates emotional situations where you feel whatever level of irritation that a healthy biology person would experience. But then do you have the electrons it takes in your brain at that one point in the right place at the right time for you to not respond in a way that later you're going to be ashamed of or wish that you didn't? And we learn as fat people that, all right, somehow I'm going to manage all this and I'm going to put one foot in front of the other. And we become really good at managing whatever energy we do have. It is quite liberating to have enough energy because, like, oh, I handled that situation like a boss. Like, that was easy. And the amount of work and stress and struggle that it took, it goes way down when you get your body working. And that's why my second big book, which is called Headstrong, is about, okay, and if the first book's like, how do you eat? The second book is, how do you make sure there's enough electricity in your brain all the time so you can handle whatever life brings your way? And okay, if the first one is how to make my body work the way I want it to, the second one is how to make my brain work. Then my third big book was, all right, I have more energy now at 46 than I did at 26. A lot more energy and more focus and more peace. And just in a way that's really profound for me, because it was so bad. I had massive brain fog in my mid-20s. You know, went to multiple doctors for it, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to figure out why my body wasn't working. And the new book called Game Changers is, all right, I just interviewed almost 500 people on Bulletproof Radio. And if you talk to people who've changed their field of medicine, or people who've won a Nobel Prize, or people who are Navy SEALs, and you say, all right, what do these masters believe in common? Because it's very risky, just like with food. Mm-hmm. I'm going to follow this one food principle. Let's say whole grains are good for me, right? And I'm just going to do that. So I'm just going to swamp myself with whole grains. Well, if it's wrong, you're totally screwed. But even if it was right, it might be that they need to have butter on them for it to really work. But if you only test whole grains and you only test butter and you never test the two of them together, you would never know. So combinations matter. The system of biology matters really greatly. So if you follow one guru who says the secret to everything is wake up at 3:30 a.m. and twirl around six times to your left and it'll all work. It might actually work for six people. You're just not one of the six. So I went through with Game Changers and I said, all right, what piece of advice or three pieces of advice would all of these people have in common? And I worked with a statistician, structured interview for 500 Game Changers, and came down with 46 laws of high performance. These are what the people who are the best at their fields, what they actually do. So people have changed the world in their own way. And I learned a lot just by looking at the commonalities instead of just what one person does.
I want to get to those commonalities, but I think it's really interesting what you're saying about how people feel when they're overweight or they don't have energy, they're in brain fog. And what's interesting to me is you were doing so many different things to try and kickstart your life and your energy and lose weight. How did you know which things were the most important to do? It just seemed like you did so much. And I think a lot of people don't see the connection between one thing and feeling better. What are the things that you did that you think were the biggest game changers for you?
I started out saying, all right, I'm going to try one thing at a time. So, you know, I went out and I bought a bunch of supplements. I said, all right, I'm going to try vitamin C for this month.
kind of works. Right.
Next month, I'll stop trying vitamin C and I'll try vitamin E. The next month, I'll try vitamin B1. And after about 6 months of this, I just did a little bit of math. And I said, if I try one thing for a month for the rest of my life, I will try approximately 0.1% of the universe of things to try.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now back to our show.
This strategy sucks and it creates lots of suffering. And what is the validity of the assumption that it's just one thing? And that comes out of this reductionist Western medicine sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is one thing. Like, oh, someone shot you. Okay, well, I'm pretty sure the bullet was the one thing when it hit you. But for chronic thing or for anti-aging, it's a system. And it isn't just one thing. It's a multitude of things. And as a computer hacker, which is my background, the thing that really inspired me to create biohacking is like, look, we can largely control the internet even when we don't know everything about its state right now. Different people control different routers and different computers, and your phone's connected, my phone's connected. I don't control your phone, or maybe I do. But the whole point of all this is, how do you control your biology when you don't know everything about how it works? And there, it's more like herding cats or influencing the wind in a room. You put a fan on, you don't control every molecule of air. You just kind of got the warm air to go over there. Well, what that means is, if your goal is to do something, then you do everything that is likely to have a high return on investment all at the same time, unless you have data that that conflicts. And then you're like, oh my God, my brain started working. I love my life. I have so much energy. And then you say, okay, this is taking an hour a day and it's costing me $1,000 a month. Right. This isn't really sustainable, but I got my results. Yeah. Maybe I'll stop the most expensive one first and see if it still works. Mm-hmm. And then you'll back off the next one. So do everything that might work all at once, get the win, get the energy from the win, and then figure out which ones were less important. And that's what I did with hundreds of thousands of dollars. At this point, I've spent more than $1 million on my own biology. And that's what I did with nutrition and with sleep and developing new sleep hacks. And a lot of the sleep hacking articles you read online are basically mimicking the early advice from 10 years of gathering my sleep data with EEG on my head when I slept at night and saying, what seems to give me more deep sleep? And then developing that skill of correlating, how do I feel right now with what did I do in the last minute, the last half hour, the last hour, the last day, the last week, the last month, and just finding the patterns and then testing them to see if they're valid. And if they are, sharing them. And when everyone says, oh my God, like, I'm pretty sure that one's something we didn't notice. Bulletproof coffee is an example of that. Yeah. I used to put milk in my coffee that disables the antioxidants in the coffee. And I used to drink coffee that made me feel cranky and jittery and all that. Well, what if you had changed what was in the coffee beans? What if instead of that bad protein from milk, you just put in the milk fat? It's called butter, right? And what if you added not coconut oil, but another oil that is much stronger for ketosis? What if you did all those together? Well, okay, it works. 200 million cups of coffee later, I'm pretty darn convinced of that. But what if instead I said, I'm just going to test black coffee and I'm just going to test butter. I'm just going to test brand octane oil. They all have their own independent things. It's the combination of things that's the key. The same is true for meditation. Like, I'm going to do only one kind of meditation. I'm going to do one kind of special breathing. There's actually a whole toolbox out there. And if you want to fix your car and you only have a screwdriver, you're not going to do a good job either. So it's life is harder than we want it to be.
It is. And I love what you're saying, because I think the biggest thing is for any individual to feel like it is possible to feel better. because so many people get stuck, exactly what you were saying before, they get stuck feeling lousy and thinking that's some kind of normal for them. So I love what you're saying, that you do everything, you have that feeling of feeling better. Once you know that's possible, it just opens so many doors. So will you step back for a second and define biohacking for people that aren't familiar with the term?
Yes.
Thank you.
Biohacking is a word that I started using last year. It was added to Merriam-Webster's dictionary as a new word language, and my name is in the definition. So people call me the father of biohacking, but it was a community movement, and it's one that I like to think that I started, helped to start, named, whatever you want to call it. The definition that I very carefully wrote, and it's not the exact definition that's in the dictionary, but the one that's popularized and behind the biohacking conference, it's the art and science of changing the environment around you and inside of you so that you have full control of your own biology. And the control, Patricia, you may have very different goals than I do. My goal may be just to fit in a dress and yours may be to run a marathon. Okay. I actually don't have a goal of fitting in a dress, but the deal is you have no idea what my goals are. I just want control, right? So I also may want my brain to work. I may want to just do anything. I'm going to grow a third arm. It doesn't matter. It's a fundamental human desire to just make our bodies do what we want instead of to be a victim to your body being fat and tired all the time, which is really happening to more than half the country right now. Control is what unites us. The reason it says outside of you and inside of you is that your body is a slave to the environment around you. It listens to the air temperature, the toxins that you breathe and that you touch on your skin. It looks at vibration, color, temperature, sound, everything. It constantly responds without your knowledge or permission. But you can change those things if you know what the response is.
Right.
And the environment inside of you, well, what you eat and oftentimes what you don't eat have a great influence on your gut bacteria, which control your biology in ways we had no idea about even 5 years ago. And then what else is going on inside of you? Well, there's your mental environment. So if you're thinking a bunch of garbage thoughts, your assumptions about the world are flawed, it's going to create a lot of emotional stress. A recent interview I did on Bulletproof Radio, I asked a leading expert in the field, Joan Rosenberg, what percentage of emotional pain is caused by thoughts that generate feelings instead of feelings that generate thoughts? And she's like, oh, probably 70% of emotional pain is caused by physical sensations that we put a story around. In other words, you got a stomach ache and unconsciously, without any knowledge, blamed someone else for your stomach ache. And that sucks. The other 30%, though, is probably caused because you had a thought like, oh, I'm all alone, even though you're in a room full of people, or no one's ever going to help me, I'll never be safe, or whatever the negative voices in your head are. Those kind of matter, too. So the idea, you got to get on top of that environment if that's where your pollution is.
You talked in Headstrong. We're mostly talking about game changers here, but I think we're talking about Dave Asprey overall. But in Headstrong, you talked about focusing on the things you love and getting rid of the things that drain you. And you talk about how we have the power to actively create who we are, to be intentional about our aspirations. Instead of, I like this, I don't know if this was your quote or someone you were interviewing, but instead of discovering yourself, deciding who you want to be. But I think that this involves letting go of these stories that you're talking about. And you also talk a lot in the book about how we get past limiting beliefs. So will you talk a little bit about that? Like, how do we change our emotional DNA, if you will, that is so deeply based on the stories that we are stuck in?
What biohacking and just the whole world of something called epigenetics has shown us is that most genes have the ability to be turned on or off. So just because you have a gene doesn't mean that it's always going to happen. It just means that if you set up the environment around you, the gene can express itself. So when you talk about emotional DNA, it's that the emotion, the trigger may be there, but you can change your story. And one of the simplest things to do is you take a deep breath, maybe journal, and you say, all right, is this actually true? You would not believe the crap the voice in your head will feed you if you allow it.
Oh, yes, I will.
I've gone to 10-day meditation retreats with holotropic breathing. I've done breathing with Stan Grof. I went to Tibet to learn meditation from the masters, and you went to a Buddhist monastery in the remote middle of nowhere, Mount Kailash, and shamanic training at South America, ayahuasca stuff, all that. And that's to get rid of that kind of pollution and problems with thinking. what's going on is most of what is running through people's heads, even as they hear the interview right now, is an automatic judgment of whatever I'm saying. Like, that's true. That's not true. Patricia, I don't like Dave. Or, oh my God, he sounds really sexy. And I have no idea what's going on through your mind. And I never will. That's one of the things. Anytime we tell ourselves we know what someone else is thinking or feeling, we're probably wrong. We have emotions. We have mirror neurons. We can be empathetic, but you don't actually know. You just tell yourself that you know. And you also can make yourself feel responsible for that. So a common thing is, oh, how that person feels about me is my fault. When the reality of the situation is that what someone feels about you is entirely their fault and it just isn't you. You can still act with kindness and whatever, but when you take ownership of that, it causes you great pain. So sitting down, is it true? Is the number one tool set that works there. But the law that came out in Game Changers, the one you quoted there, was very interesting because the people who went out and did big things, almost none of them said, oh, I had to go find myself. Right. What they did is they said, no. So what they did is they said, who do I want to be? And they built themselves. They consciously created the person they were. And that's a very different perspective than the sort of passive finding. You can find the things that you love to do, and they may even be good to build a career or a life or to make an impact on the world to serve others. They may also just not be that useful. And you may say, I kind of like doing that, but maybe I like something else more. Those are healthy to explore.
Yeah.
But when you say, I want to be an epic human being, here are the things that I use to define epic. And then you say, what do I have to do? Who do I have to learn from? What do I need to read? Where do I have to go in order to acquire those skills and in order to change the story in my head? So instead of being, I'm not good enough, which is one of the things I certainly dealt with quite a bit, was I'm always feeling alone and I'm never going to be good enough and all this sort of self-confidence things that you don't even know are happening in your head because they happen all the time. And when I sort of became aware of those thought patterns, like, oh, I got to do something about that. And what makes me really sad, Patricia, you get these people who are like, okay, just tell yourself you are enough. I'm like, seriously, you could tell yourself anything on earth and your very best and highest aspiration was to just be enough. I'm like, that's so sad. I am so much more than enough that enough is laughable. But now we're getting there because maybe you want to have something left over after you are enough, right? But there, what's going on with the story in your head is, oh, I can't handle what life brings me. Like I'm not enough to do that.
Yeah.
The reality, almost certainly, that you're not making enough energy in your body right now to do that, because when you have enough electrons present, you can convert food and air into electricity. Well, it generates a thing called willpower. And this thing called willpower will tell you that it doesn't freaking matter if you're enough, you're going to do it anyway. And it changes the story in your head.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
I'm thinking as you're saying this, it's like, who do I want to be? And having this sort of strength and courage, it involves curiosity. It involves sort of an adventurous and a growth mindset. Do you think a lot of this comes from your meditation practice, or you refer back to your food and your diet? I mean, what combination of things do you think pushes that? Who do I want to be? And I can really be that person that I want to be mindset.
It's quite often parenting and early childhood trauma can be a part of the patterns that make you not pay attention to that. But my assessment, I mean, I'm mid-40s, so I'm not old, but I'm not young either. I've got enough mileage to have learned a few things, and I cultivate friendships with people twice my age as much as I can because they know a lot more than I do. I think sometimes you come into the world, I mean, whether it's how you're born, who you are when you're born, some people, they're just drawn to stuff. And what creates great pain is knowing that you want to do one thing and that this is your purpose, and then doing what you're supposed to do that's not your purpose. That will always create pain and suffering in your life. And that said, if you are wrong about what you think your purpose is, and you think your purpose is to be the best in a video game in the world, that might also create pain for you in a different way, but it also may create joy in a different way. So we have a lot of work to do on finding our purpose and understanding what it is. But if you say, all right, one of the first things I'm going to do, I'm going to be the kind of person who connects with their authentic purpose and someone who follows it relentlessly because that's why I'm here. That's a different kind of person than the kind of person who says, I binge watch Netflix. It's a behavior thing. The problem is that your core biology is going to tell you to binge watch Netflix and your conscious human brain is going to say, I choose to do something different. Now, who's going to win? The brain versus your core biology? It's largely a function of whether you have enough energy to do what you wanted to do instead of what your body wanted to do. It starts with food, sleep, and sunshine.
Yeah. You also say, I think this is your quote, seek out the things that fascinate them and that make them want to leap out of bed in the morning. Without passion and purpose, there's no happiness. So find things you care about and devote your life to their pursuit. And I feel like it's something we all think about, but I think it's very hard to sustain. Often when people find passion and purpose, it's for a period of time or for a project. How do you sustain that over a period of a lifetime?
Having curiosity is really important. And I got to interview Eric Kandel, who won a Nobel Prize. He's 94 now, and his Nobel Prize was for neuroplasticity. And he's in his lab outside Central Park doing active research on brains. That guy is full of passion and energy and still on his mission. He's 94. And there are so many people like that. And I asked him as part of that question for Game Changers, what are your three most important pieces of advice for someone who wants to perform better at everything they do as a human being? He kind of scrunched up his forehead and thought about it for a minute. And he said, all right, number one, have a good wife.
Okay.
For him, and he also talked about practice and some other things. That's why I give people three answers when I was working on the book. But what he said was the value of relationships in your life really matter because they help to sustain you. Right? Yeah. So for him, that was really important. For most people, though, what will sustain you for long periods of time is two things. One is gratitude, just consciously choosing to find something to be grateful for, even if something sucks, really takes the sting out of it. So it can be that way for anything from a major injury to something happened that you didn't like, or you just had to spend $1,000. Like, I'm so angry that I lost this $1,000. Yeah, I'm grateful I had $1,000 I could spend to pay this ticket or whatever it was.
Right.
Either one, you're going to give up $1,000. Either you suffered or you didn't. But choosing stories that make you suffer less will give you a lot more ability to stay on. But the final one, that the one that fuels me, is having a sense of service to others. And when you do that, things that would be impossible for you to do out of selfishness become easy. And so when you realize that what you're doing is about a lot more than you, that is probably the biggest secret to that. How do you sustain the energy? Well, if you're doing it for yourself, meh. If you're doing it to lead or inspire or help or serve or to improve things, that gives you more energy than anything else.
Such a great answer. Will you tell me a little bit about your meditation practice? I know you talked about gratitude, and it looked like you started by doing the Art of Living workshop. I know you also said you believe that there are different kinds of meditations that you should have in your toolbox along with breathing practices. So will you share a little bit about that with us?
Sure. I started it out before thinking about this in terms of timing. I started out before I did Art of Living. I did some holotropic breathing based on Stan Grof's work. Mm-hmm. Stan Grof is a psychiatrist from Czechoslovakia before it was the Czech Republic. And he treated 3,000 patients with LSD clinically and had great breakthroughs and became the father of transpersonal psychology. I ended up interviewing him on Bulletproof Radio, in fact, on stage at a Bulletproof event for Bulletproof Radio. And one of the leading luminaries in psychology who replaced these strong plant medicines with just yogic-based breathing exercises that cause you to leave your body and do all sorts of deep state work. I'd done some of that, and I'd learned, wow, there's all sorts of stuff going on in my brain that I have no knowledge of. And then I was introduced to Art of Living, which is a practice where every morning for 15 minutes, you basically make some weird sounds and do weird breathing exercises where you put your hands in different positions. I learned it from the CEO of a company I work for, and I did it every morning for 5 years. And every Saturday morning, I'd get together with a group of about 20 other people at 7 a.m. and we'd all do like an hour long session of this. It sounds kind of weird, but I'll tell you, it was like taking a mental shower every day. Like your brain worked better all day, every day. And now 15, 20 years later, we realized that breathing is fundamental to changing brain states. And I actually run a neuroscience institute that does like intensive 5-day things for executives, and having $100,000 worth of neurofeedback equipment downstairs from where I'm interviewing right now, so I can look at my own brain. Yeah, breathing kind of changes your brain state. We know that for sure. It turns out we've known that for like 5,000 years. If you were to go to India, they just didn't have the electrical signal, but they could tell because they were paying attention. So I started with breathing. I also, I went to, in the late 90s, I went to Peru. I did ayahuasca with a shaman, which isn't a meditative practice per se, but it introduces you to the meditative states. I've used light sound goggles for 20 years. I've used electrical stimulation across my brain for also 20 years, which can cause your brain to go into specific meditative states. I'm a huge fan of neurofeedback to meditate faster than you otherwise could. And I've been to the monastery in Nepal and through Tibet, and I'll do a variety of meditations based on how much time I have and what I'm looking to get out of it. One of the things I've been doing lately that I've found to be really effective on a per minute basis is Dr. Barry Morguelan's audio files. He's one of 12 living grandmasters of this lineage from Lao Tzu and a doctor from UCLA. And I've interviewed him a couple times on the show. He's one of these guys, I think he's in his 70s now, so I learned a lot from him. But I listen to those meditation things, which have a lot of energy, movement, visualizations. Stuff happens that isn't normal in a 15 or 20 minute meditation. So I'm looking for effectiveness per minute. If I can meditate 8 hours a day like monks used to, or 12 hours a day, whatever, that'd be great. Of course, I'm a dad. I'm an author, a podcaster. There's just no time. So I want to squeeze the maximum I can into it. And that's why I'm such a fan of tech, to just stop wasting time in order to allow you to meditate.
When you talk about neurofeedback, what kind of devices or technology are you using to impact your brain or to see the impact on your brain?
It really depends on where I am, what I've got with me, and the amount of time. So at the very lowest possible end is a tech that I've worked with since 2008 called heart rate variability.
Right.
And this is something where if you breathe right and you do something weird in your chest at the same time, that's more of a sensation, you can change the space between your heartbeats, which is shown to correlate to changes in how your brain works. I was CTO of one of the wristband tracking companies a while back that Intel bought for $100 million and really got into the science of that. So if that's at the very low level, next up from that in terms of accessibility is like the Muse headset. Right? The Muse headset is something you can put on. It's small, it's portable. And if you're going to meditate for X amount of time and you have a signal that says, hey, you're doing something wrong, you're going to get more value out of your meditation. Absolutely. And probably, I guess before both of those, if you really want to look at tech, having the ability to use your phone to listen to an audio file for meditation will usually give you a better meditation than just doing it by yourself, if you consider that to be tech. And then above that, there's clinical grade neurofeedback stuff. And that's what I do at 40 Years of Zen, the institute. There we have pulsed magnets that we put on your head or shaped electrical currents to increase levels of brain-derived nootropic factor, and 24-channel clinical grade EEGs that are very quantitative. You're probably not going to go for an advanced Zen master state in a 20-minute meditation. You could just sit there and do breathing exercises. It might be nice to learn how to meditate with tech and then be able to do it without the tech so that you're not reliant.
Do you have a practice every morning where you sit for several minutes, or you're doing all of these different things throughout your day, your month?
I had a great practice going every morning, and then I had kids.
Oh, okay. Okay, you have.
And I'll just tell you this. People have kids know what I'm talking about. They will hex when you wake up. It doesn't matter. I'll wake up at 3 in the morning. They'll do that too. Okay. It doesn't matter how quiet you are.
Yeah.
They're like little radar things. And they'll interrupt your meditation. It's their job to do that.
Okay. Hence why
my morning practice involves coffee and driving kids to school and not turning on my phone until after I drop them off. After that, I will say every day I do not meditate. I have that unique ability to have insane amounts of technology in my house because one of my portfolio companies. So what I will typically do is once every week or two, I'll spend an hour or two in very, very deep states guided by high-end system. And that seems to be enough for me right now, but I would love to do an hour a day. I just allocate my hours per day in a different way, which is a fancy way of saying I'm too busy to meditate. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is if I meditate, I'm only doing like the rocket fuel, nuclear powered meditation because I don't have a lot of time. So I'm going to cram it all in there. But I do take the time to put myself into these states. And then you do micro meditation. It's like, well, you go to bed. That's a form of meditation on gratitude that's really potent. So I do that every night.
That's awesome. Well, it seems like you do have a lot going on. So I can see how it might be hard to siphon that time off. But it also seems like, and you talk about this a lot in the book, that this idea of self-awareness and being able to witness ourselves in different situations. And when you have that self-awareness, you probably know when you must go meditate. You know how to take care of yourself, I would think, after all of the work that you've been doing over the last many, many years. And I'm curious, like, I really want to know, like, what changed you the most after like the 500 interviews that you've done and hearing everyone's secrets to their lives? What changed in you after doing all of these interviews? And I know you're still doing them, but you've put a lot of these game changers in the book. So curious, what were the biggest changes for you?
So writing Game Changers involved about 500 of these interviews. That's 500 hours of picking the brains of people who've done really cool things. The real challenge was going through all the transcripts and saying, wow, what do all these people have in common? Like, where do they agree? So it requires a lot of structured thinking in order to either write a book or teach a class. Those are the two ways you really learn something at the core. Because in order to come up with the format of those 46 laws, I probably had to consider 500 laws. And then how do I present them to you to read? So that thought process, I think, indelibly etched that stuff into my human operating system. And probably the thing that stands out the most is what no one ever answered that question when I was doing the interviews for Game Changers. No one ever said money, knowing that this is one of those most important things for performing better as a human being. There was never money. There was never fame. There was never power. And there was never even sex. Although there are four laws about sex in the book, but it wasn't that the answer to sex was like the goal. Like, sex is a massive source of energy. When you do it right, it's different for men and women. Here's the rules. So I got that in there.
Right.
But the things that are core, like mitochondrial drives for survival, human needs hierarchy, and all that kind of stuff. These people were not out for fame and power and money. They were out for doing good. That was really profound for me. And the other one that stood out, which is one of the three big areas of focus for Game Changers, it's this idea that these people did not do things to become happy. They learned how to become happy, which enabled them to do great things. And I know when I was young, I made $6 million when I was 26. I lost it when I was 28, which was unfortunate. But when I had $6 million, I looked at a friend at the same company where we all made more money than we should have. And I said, I'll be happy when I have $10 million.
Yeah.
I wasn't happy with six. I wasn't going to be happy with 10. So maybe the secret there, the thing I didn't know in my 20s was, hey, figure out how to be happy. And you just don't have to put money in the equation or anything else. And when you get some level of skill there, which is a meditation thing usually, and sometimes it may be changing relationships in your life if you have toxic ones. But whatever it is, you do that. And then all of a sudden, wow, like the money comes, the success comes, if money is part of what you need for your success. But the thing that you wanted to do, it just got easy.
Did you have a favorite interview?
It's really hard to pick a favorite one. We're talking Eric Kandel stands out, Stan Grof stands out. These are guys who are in their 90s who have changed the world in profound and massive ways. And to be able to learn from them, just ask them any question I want. And then to have the obligation to shape that into a summary of that advice so that someone can read it in 30 seconds and get the nuggets from that. Those are some pretty amazing guys. But the one that maybe stands out the most, I don't know if it's the most, but one of my favorite ones was Laura Logan, the 60 Minutes correspondent. It was such a raw, real interview. She was nearly killed. He went through a really traumatic experience in Egypt, a lot of people are familiar with. But we talked about what was going through her mind and how did she heal and just the stuff like, wow, how does someone at that level overcome something that would be impossible to overcome in most people's view of the world? And so to have the honor of being able to ask someone those questions.
Thank you so much for being here with me today. I love the impact that you've had on so many people. Is there anything else that you want to share before we close?
There's a Henry Miller quote that's really cool that sums up a lot of this. He says that the goal of life is not to accumulate power, but to radiate it. And the people who I interviewed for Game Changers, the ones who formed all that good advice in the book, I think they live that very much because when you die, whatever, power, money, fortune, fame, whatever, doesn't really matter. But what you did when you were alive there, the stuff you radiated into others, that's what's going to make you happy along the way.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really succinct and cool quote. I would ask listeners, hey, check out Game Changers. If you want to spend about 4 hours compressing 500 hours of interviews with awesome people, I promise you that the return on investment for that book in terms of the amount of time that you'll spend versus the knowledge you get, it is the highest that I know how to deliver. So this is just an awesome book.
I agree. And I think going back to how we change ourselves physically, emotionally, spiritually, I feel like you've covered it all in this book. So thank you for writing it. And thank you for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Patricia. Have a great day.
Grateful that Dave was able to be here today. You can find his books at all major booksellers. And to find out more about the Bulletproof Diet and brand, check out bulletproof.com. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at founders@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to check out Meditation Studio in the App Store and check out Muse at choosemuse.com. We'll see you next time.